Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Alex Astor. We are really peeling back the layers of the global financial system this week.
That's right. And our focus is the detailed, hard-hitting analysis you find inside Barron's magazine for the week of October 13th, 2025.
It's packed this week.
Absolutely. Our mission here is pretty singular. We want to give you, the listener, a thorough, comprehensive, and hopefully engaging report on the most critical financial narratives, market moves, and investment strategies that are detailed in this week's issue.
Yeah, if you want to get rapidly well-informed on, you know, everything from these huge AI financing deals to, surprisingly, the psychology of wealth, well, we've dug into it for you.
We're dealing with unprecedented spending, big geopolitical risks, even some really deep critiques of central banks.
A lot to cover. So let's just jump right in with what's dominating everything right now, AI. The centrality of AI, these massive corporate bets, and the hardware engine demanding all this cash.
We absolutely have to kick things off with the cover story. It's squarely focused on Larry Ellison and, well, his latest big move with Oracle. Alex, the scale of Oracle's success lately is just monumental.
Oh, it is. We're talking stock performance up, what, 373% over just 3 years?
Exactly. Which just crushes the S&P 500's 87% gain. It even beats giants like Microsoft, who only managed 123%.
Right. And what's really fascinating here, I think, is the sort of ideological victory this represents for Ellison. You know, AI validates his lifelong belief that data, centralized processing, robust backends, that's the core, not consumer gadgets or social media.
So large language models need exactly what he's been building for decades.
Precisely. These giant integrated systems. And now, you know, at 81, he's leveraging that into maybe his biggest bet ever, certainly his most audacious one.
Audacious is definitely the word, especially when you look at the numbers tied to this this rumored massive deal with OpenAI. Reporting suggests it's worth $300 billion.
Yeah, $300 billion. Just staggering.
So for listeners who maybe don't track these specific metrics every day, how do we actually measure the impact of a deal that size on a company like Oracle?
Okay, so that's where you look at this key metric, remaining performance obligations, or RPOs.
Yeah.
It's basically the backlog, right? Signed contracts for future revenue.
This stuff they have to deliver.
Exactly. And the reporting says this one deal drove Oracle's RPOs from about $99 billion up to an incredible $455 billion.
Wow. That's more than quadrupling their backlog, mostly from one customer.
Pretty much. It instantly guarantees this huge pipeline, but, and this is the crucial point you raised, it comes at a tremendous immediate cost.
Right. The price.
Yeah. This future guarantee is actually driving Oracle's current finances negative.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time since like 1990, Oracle is turning free cash negative.
Free cash negative. Wow.
They're spending tens of billions, not millions, billions on CapEx, mostly buying NVIDIA chips, building out cloud capacity. So they're burning cash now to fulfill, you know, $250 billion promise later.
That sounds like a genuinely terrifying move for any company, especially one as established as Oracle. Is there any historical parallel for sacrificing cash flow like this for such a huge long-term infrastructure play?
Well, it kind of recalls Amazon's early AWS build-out, right? But even that didn't happen quite this fast. Analysts are projecting Oracle's cloud revenue costs could soar, like from maybe $11 billion today up to over $72 billion by 2029.
$72 billion, just in costs.
Yeah. And that kind of spending is set to push their gross margin down sharply, potentially from, say, 72% down to around 52%.
So they're trading margin and cash now for market share later.
Exactly. Sacrificing 20 points of margin for dominance and hoping for like $160 billion revenue run rate in 4 years. It's a massive gamble on capturing the market now and sorting out profitability down the road.
And Ellison isn't just sticking to the cloud. He's making these big moves in media too, right? Backing his son David's company, Skydance.
Mm-hmm. Skydance just bought Paramount, acquired the Free Press, and apparently they're eyeing Warner Bros. Discovery too.
What's the angle there? Applying a tech sensibility.
That's the phrase used. It's about leveraging Oracle's data and cloud might for new ways to distribute and monetize content. But the financial links are what really caught Barron's eye. Larry Ellison has reportedly pledged something like 346 million shares of Oracle stock.
Oh.
An estimated $100 billion. Pledged as collateral for personal loans to fund these outside media ventures.
Pledging $100 billion of his own stock. I mean, that's immense personal risk if Oracle shares wobble even a little. It shows conviction, sure, but also Wow, high leverage.
It absolutely does. And we can't forget the geopolitical angle here, too, with their renewed bid for TikTok USA control through Project Texas.
Ah, yes, Project Texas, isolating U.S. user data.
Right. So Oracle's bid isn't just about media. It's fundamentally about securing a massive isolated cloud customer and its licensed algorithm. It's a geopolitical cloud hosting deal first, media plays second.
That's a really crucial distinction. Okay, so shifting from Oracle's software and cloud bets, let's look at the hardware, the actual engines driving all this AI demand. Dell Technologies. Barron's highlighted Dell as a compelling stock to buy now.
Yeah, and for good reason, they argue. Dell isn't just the legacy PC business anymore. They're really transforming into a primary player in high-growth AI servers.
But the market's missing it.
That's the argument. The market seems to be missing it. Dell's trading at just 14.5 times forward earnings. Compare that to the S&P 500 average of 22 times. That gap suggests investors are still thinking old PC company, not pricing in the new AI growth.
But the numbers show the shift is happening. Their infrastructure solutions group grew 44% year over year in Q2.
Exactly. And the servers and networking part, that just exploded, up 69%. Management sounds confident too, projecting over $20 billion in AI server sales this year.
$20 billion? That's substantial.
It's massive. And you see these high-profile customer examples, like Elon Musk's xAI reportedly agreeing to buy $5 billion worth of Dell servers.
So Dell's strategy is smart here, targeting mid-size enterprises.
Yeah, their competitive niche seems clever. They're going after those mid-size enterprise customers, kind of avoiding a direct all-out war with the big hyperscalers, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, who are trying to build their own custom AI servers anyway. Dell wants to be the go-to for everyone else needing that specialized AI infrastructure right now.
And financially, they seem well-positioned for it. Over $8 billion cash on the books, projecting $7 billion annual free cash flow.
Absolutely. That gives them a huge buffer, supports potential M&A if the right deal comes along.
But there are risks.
Oh, for sure. We have to acknowledge the risk.
Right.
Fierce competition. If those hyperscalers do perfect their in-house servers quickly, or if just the overall AI spending frenzy slows down, Dell's momentum could stall.
And that brings us perfectly to the next really critical question, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. The big one.
While Dell looks strong, relying on AI sales leads us right into the biggest fear hanging over this whole sector. Is this growth sustainable, or are we just staring down the barrel of another massive tech bubble like the dot-com era?
That anxiety is everywhere, and it's understandable. The piece tackles that fear head on. The issue is, this AI boom is already so deeply embedded. You know, nearly three quarters of the top 10 S&P 500 returns are tied directly to this AI story.
So it's not fringe.
Not at all. But the sources highlight what they see as a critical structural flaw. They actually call it AI polyamory.
AI polyamory, I love that term. Okay, help us visualize this jarring circular financial relationship.
Okay, think of it like a really tightly closed loop. All the key players depend on each other, but there are also massive counterparty risks for one another.
Right.
So you have like NVIDIA funding OpenAI,
right,
which then turns around and signs these huge RPO deals with Oracle, AMD, and suppliers like CoreWeave. But then those suppliers, Oracle and CoreWeave, they have to spend enormous amounts of capital, often buying NVIDIA chips, right? To service the demand generated by the companies NVIDIA funded in the first place.
Wow, that sounds incredibly concentrated if one piece fails.
The whole thing ripples. It's extremely concentrated. That's the critical point. OpenAI, which is, let's be clear, a money-losing startup right now, accounts for something like two-thirds of the remaining performance obligations at Oracle and 40% at CoreWeave.
Two-thirds? From OpenAI alone?
Yeah. So if OpenAI, for whatever reason, maybe lack of commercial success, maybe internal issues, if they can't meet those obligations, those RPOs suddenly become huge liabilities for their suppliers. The whole structure feels, well, precariously balanced on the immediate success of this one highly ambitious venture.
And that ambition is fueling just an unprecedented spending binge. We're hearing Sam Altman pitching a $1 trillion spending hook for AI infrastructure, including building 16 gigawatts of data centers globally. Can you put that number in context?
It's genuinely jaw-dropping. That $1 trillion, it dwarfs the entire amount ever raised by all tech IPOs combined over the last 45 years. Even adjusted for inflation, that's only about $600 billion. This isn't just a big funding round. It's like restructuring global capital allocation.
And the constraints aren't just money.
No, exactly. The constraints are physical. Power. Simple as that.
Power!
Right. A 16-gigawatt data center infrastructure. That needs the generating capacity of roughly 15 new nuclear reactors. This whole vision relies heavily on debt and equity financing at a scale we've just never seen before.
And unlike past big debt loads, the collateral isn't tangible.
Well, that's the concern. Mm. Historically, big debtors had tangible assets, think wireless spectrum for telecoms. Here, the collateral is really the uncertain future profitability of AI services. It's a different kind of risk.
So given this huge risk and dependency, Barron's outlines four potential ways this explosive rally could, well, end.
Yeah, they lay out four scenarios. First, the simple physical one.
Yeah.
We just can't produce enough power to feed AI's exponential appetite. Second, investors just wake up. They start doubting the actual profitability of all this spending. High revenue doesn't automatically mean high earnings, right?
Sure.
Third, the market sours on the negative returns on invested capital at big tech. People realize they're just shoveling money into infrastructure without seeing immediate profitable results.
Makes sense.
And finally, maybe the most surprising one, big tech itself changes strategy. They decide to prioritize returning cash to shareholders' dividends, buybacks, instead of just endlessly pouring money into more AI infrastructure.
Interesting. So whether the bubble bursts or just sort of deflates, protecting your portfolio means hedging against these big structural risks. The piece gave a great breakdown of five major market fears and specific hedge ideas.
Yeah, let's run through those. Fear number one, always lurking, but maybe more severe now, a blow up of the U.S. deficit and the bond market. Debt's heading towards $37 trillion.
And investors are getting nervous about treasuries.
Increasingly so, especially foreign investors. So the proposed hedge is really specific. High-quality corporate debt. They point to Apple's AAA bonds, which are currently yielding more than comparable U.S. treasuries.
Wait, more than treasuries? So investors see Apple as safer than the U.S. government right now.
That's the core insight. It's a political risk premium baked into treasuries. Investors are demanding more compensation for holding U.S. government debt because they see political dysfunction shutdowns, default threats, deficits as a bigger risk than Apple's balance sheet stability. It's kind of wild.
But the reassurance is that a full U.S. default is still highly unlikely.
Historically, yes. Cooler heads tend to prevail eventually. Still, the pricing tells a story.
Okay, fear number two, a major China crisis. Either military aggression towards Taiwan or a really escalating trade war, especially with those 100% tariff threats.
The hedge here ties back, surprisingly, to AI, defense AI companies.
Defense AI.
Yeah, the thinking is if geopolitical tensions spike, spending on next-gen defense will shoot up. Companies like Palantir, whose CEO literally says they're powering the West, or drone makers like AeroVironment and Kratos Defense, they likely benefit hugely from things like the planned $175 billion Golden Dome missile defense system.
But the piece also adds a reality check.
Right. Remember the structural reality.
Yeah.
The U.S. and China are still fundamentally codependent economic roommates. They rely on each other for stable trade and finance, despite the rhetoric.
Okay, third fear, stagflation. That awful mix of slowing growth and rising inflation may be kicked off if the Fed cuts rates too fast while new tariffs keep prices high.
Yeah, stagflation is nasty. For hedging that, you want businesses with steady, reliable cash flows and pricing power. Think communications, entertainment giants, Apple, Netflix, maybe Spotify. Companies that can pass cost increases on.
Or real assets.
Or the classic hedge.
Yeah.
Real assets and commodities. They tend to track rising prices. That helps explain the current rally we're seeing in gold and other hard assets.
Which leads to fear number four, the dollar nosedive, or this de-dollarization trend we keep hearing about.
Mm-hmm.
The dollar index had its worst 6 months since the early 80s.
The hedge there is pretty clear. Hard assets again. Gold has been the main beneficiary, right?
Yeah.
Up 50% year to date, hitting $4,000 an ounce recently. Central banks are just loading up.
And crypto.
That's the more volatile alternative. Bitcoin projected by some towards maybe $165,000. But again, the reassurance provides perspective. Global commerce just doesn't have a credible dollar alternative right now. The euro, the yuan, the yen, they all have their own deep structural problems.
Right. Okay, finally, fear number five, very relevant to our earlier chat, an actual AI bubble crash. If those disruptors we talked about happen, the biggest, most concentrated stocks could plunge.
Yeah, the mega caps get hit hardest. So the defense is basically diversification away from that concentration. You could simply buy an equal weighted S&P 500 fund. It gives every company the same weight, not just the tech giants.
Or pivot to power providers.
Utilities like Constellation Energy or NextEra Energy. The logic is kind of elegant. AI is still going to need massive amounts of guaranteed energy, regardless of whether NVIDIA's or Oracle's stock valuation holds up.
The infrastructure spending creates real demand, even if the stock valuations were frothy.
Exactly. The demand for power is locked in. The utilities benefit either way.
Okay, that sets a strong stage for both risk and concentration. Now let's maybe shift gears from those big market risks and look at some specific opportunities, particularly in the high yield space. And then maybe dive into the surprising psychology of financial fear.
Sounds good.
Let's start with business development companies, or BDCs. The yields here look incredibly tempting right now.
They really do. I mean, potentially a phenomenal return profile. BDCs are yielding 10% or more. Some, like FSKKR, are way up there, pushing 19.5%.
19%, wow.
Yeah. And crucially, they're currently trading at a median 20% discount to their net asset value, their NAV, after a pretty sharp sell-off recently.
And historically, that discount level is a buy signal.
Historically, yes. When the discount hits that 20% level, BDCs have, on average, delivered returns of around 40% over the following year. And that's on top of the double-digit yield.
That's a staggering potential return. So why did they sell off? It started mid-September, which feels counterintuitive if yields are generally high.
Yeah, it was triggered by the Fed cutting its key short rate. To understand why, you need to know how BDC loans work. They make loans, usually secured loans, to mid-sized private companies, and the returns on those loans float.
They move with interest rates.
Exactly. They're indexed to short-term rates, like the Fed funds rate.
Yeah.
So when the Fed cut rates, the immediate fear was, oh no, BDC's income is going to drop, which could lead to dividend cuts, maybe a percentage point or more if the Fed keeps easing. That uncertainty just hammered the market.
So the sell-off wasn't about bad loans or credit quality. It was purely policy risk hitting future income expectations.
Precisely. It's exposure to interest rate risk, not necessarily credit risk worsening. BDCs are structured to make these secured, high-rate loans, often to companies involved in leveraged buyouts, valued under $5 billion. They avoid corporate taxes by passing almost all income to investors.
But there are risks inherent in the structure too, right? Leverage, fees.
Oh, yes. The risks are real. They often use significant leverage, maybe $1 of debt for every $1 of equity, which magnifies volatility. And the fees can be high, sometimes 4% or more annually. Plus, they can be volatile because individual investors drive a lot of the trading.
So in this sector, how do you separate the good opportunities from the potentially risky ones?
Quality is absolutely paramount. You have to focus on BDCs with a large chunk of their portfolio in high-quality senior secured loans and that are trading at a deep discount.
Senior secured meaning first in line if things go bad.
Exactly. First lien, they get paid back first if the borrower defaults. So companies like Blackstone secured lending, over 95% first lien secured, minimal loans, not accruing interest, or Morgan Stanley Direct Lending Fund, also at a good discount. Those are highlighted as stronger plays, basically letting you potentially capitalize on temporary policy fear for long-term value.
Okay, let's shift gears completely now. Moving from the sort of mathematical side of money to the psychological, there's a fascinating piece on how the wealthy apparently aren't immune to financial worries. Money just swaps old problems for new, deeply personal anxieties.
It's a really powerful, counterintuitive finding, isn't it? Advisors report the biggest anxiety among wealthy clients often isn't market loss. It's the fear of creating family strife through inheritance planning.
Not market crashes, but family fights.
Yeah. And it's not just about dividing assets equally. It's about achieving fairness, especially in complex situations like blended families or when kids have had very different levels of financial support during their lives. You know, one child needed college paid for, another needed help with medical bills.
So if the will just says equal split, but the lifetime financial history was unequal, conflict is almost baked in. What's the suggested solution?
Radical transparency, essentially. Open communication while the parents are alive. Explaining the fair reasoning behind the decisions. Why one trust might be structured differently than another based on past support or current needs. That proactive communication can head off so much bitterness later.
And for business founders or top execs, retirement isn't just sunshine and golf. There's this massive identity crisis when they step away from a career that defined them.
Yes. Advisors are realizing the biggest danger for many clients isn't running out of money, it's running out of purpose.
What now? Problem.
Exactly. So they're proactively tackling this. They include a crucial item in pre-exit planning, the Monday morning discussion, forcing clients to think rigorously about what will actually get them out of bed after that initial retirement glow fades, planning for the loss of identity, status.
That's smart. We also got some really interesting insights from Vanguard on just general investor psychology, especially how powerful our early experiences are.
Oh, this is so critical. They track how emotions just sabotage investing. They highlight this concept called first impression bias.
First impression bias.
Yeah. Investors who started their journey during really bad markets, say the dot-com bust or the 2008 financial crisis, they hold consistently lower median equity allocations decades later. It's measurable.
Decades later.
Decades later. Someone who started in the 90s bull market might hold, say, 86% in equities today. But someone who started during the 08 crisis might only hold something in the low 70s. That early negative experience, maybe 20 years ago, structurally biases them towards lower long-term returns, purely out of fear.
They're perpetually missing out on potential gains because of a trauma from long ago.
Exactly. And then here's maybe the most striking finding related to financial well-being. The $2,000 buffer.
The $2,000 buffer.
Yeah. Vanguard found that having just $2,000 set aside in dedicated emergency savings provides a boost to someone's feeling of financial well-being that is comparable to having $1 million in total assets.
Wait, $2,000 feels psychologically similar to having $1 million? How does that tiny buffer create such an outsized benefit?
It dramatically reduces what economists call the scarcity mindset. That $2,000 just eliminates the constant low-level worry about unexpected bills, the car repair, the urgent vet visit, whatever. It frees up mental bandwidth, roughly fewer hours a week, just managing cash flow anxiety.
Wow.
And critically, the study found people with this buffer are significantly more likely to contribute to their retirement plan and less likely to cash it out during some temporary crisis. It changes the game. Short-term stability enables confident long-term saving. It's not either. They support each other.
That's a really powerful lesson in the physics of financial fear. Okay, let's shift now to the big picture. Macroeconomic policy. The geopolitical landscape. Starting right at the top. The battle for the Fed chair. Kevin Warsh, a top contender to replace Jerome Powell, is making his philosophy known, and it's a direct challenge to the current Fed.
Oh, yeah. Warsh's philosophy is built on a pretty sharp critique. He channels former chair Paul Volcker, who famously said the Fed's job is twofold. Get rates roughly right and look like you know what you're doing, maintain credibility. Warsh basically says the Powell Fed has failed on both measures. He argues they've fundamentally mistaken their own power.
How did the market recently challenge the Fed's power, according to Warsh?
He points to that moment where the Fed cut its short-term rate,
right,
trying to ease conditions, lower long-term rates, but the market didn't buy it. The 10-year Treasury yield actually rose by a full percentage point right after.
The opposite of what the Fed wanted.
Exactly. The market effectively said, nope, we don't believe you,
yeah,
driving up mortgage costs, consumer debt costs, despite the Fed's action. Credibility gap.
And Warsh's solution involves a pretty massive structural overhaul rooted in an economic philosophy that's been out of favor for a while.
Yes. He's advocating for a regime change centered on monetarism.
Monetarism. Remind us.
Right. So monetarism is the idea that inflation is fundamentally caused by government spending and money printing too much money, chasing too few goods. It's not primarily driven by temporary things like supply chains or wage hikes, which is more the current Fed consensus view. Warsh argues the Fed is just treating symptoms, not the root cause, exploding government balance sheets.
And this leads him to propose structural reform, including updating the 1951 Treasury-Fed Accord. That sounds technical, but foundational. What's the significance of that old agreement?
The 51 Accord was huge.
Hmm.
It established the Fed's independence from the Treasury Department. Before that, the Treasury could basically tell the Fed what interest rates to set. Warsh's proposal isn't to totally undo independence, but to limit the Fed's adventures into what he sees as quasi-fiscal policy. He wants to downsize the Fed, limit its authority in areas like banking supervision, and most critically, shrink that enormous $6.6 trillion balance sheet by updating the accord. He wants to share the responsibility for balance sheet reduction with the Treasury Secretary. It would fundamentally redraw the lines of monetary and fiscal power.
Huge potential change. Meanwhile, back in the present, we're dealing with the immediate chaos of political instability. The threat of a severe government shutdown, driven this time by fights over Obamacare subsidies.
Yeah, markets seem dangerously complacent about this, but the risk feels very real. The immediate economic hit is severe disruption. 2 million federal workers, 1.3 million military personnel, potentially missing paychecks starting this month.
And the piece highlights a particularly nasty potential twist this time.
Yes, a deeper risk. The possibility that politicians might refuse to grant back pay to furloughed workers once the shutdown eventually ends. That would create much deeper, longer-lasting economic scars than we've seen in past shutdowns. Real damage to trust and stability.
And for Medicare recipients who are right in the middle of open enrollment season, the timing is just terrible.
Exactly. Awful timing. While core services continue and the open enrollment period itself, October 15 to 7, goes ahead, the details might be impacted. The crucial plan comparison data on Medicare.gov, which people need to navigate complex choices, could be delayed or limited because staff are furloughed.
So the advice is?
Don't wait. Review your annual notice of change immediately. Don't put off making coverage decisions until the last minute because the data you need might suddenly become unavailable.
Good advice. Okay, next up, we see a really profound economic implication of policy, this time looking at immigration restrictions. There's specific academic research showing that when companies face limits on hiring skilled foreign workers, mainly through H-1B visa caps, they dramatically increase M&A activity.
This is the acqui-hire phenomenon in action, directly driven by policy. Companies are basically forced to buy other companies, often paying a premium, just to get the talent they need, because the domestic labor market can't fill these severe shortages.
Especially in areas like AI and biotech.
Exactly. Human capital-intensive sectors. The acquisitions tend to be small, targeted deals, perfectly correlated with the specific skills they were blocked from hiring directly via visas.
That seems like a highly inefficient way to acquire talent. What are the longer-term implications mentioned?
Well, the long-term picture is pretty worrying, according to this research. Restricting immigration like this ultimately chokes off vital networks of trust, investment, and also future consumers needed to support the U.S. economy long-term.
And there's a fiscal cost, too.
A huge one, often ignored in the political debate. The study underscores that the average immigrant contributes a net present value of $259,000 to federal, state, and local governments over their lifetime. That's a massive fiscal return that's being actively restricted by these policies.
Wow. Okay, on a more positive geopolitical note, maybe. Latin America stock funds seem to be defying all the recent political noise and trade war talk. They're soaring, even with threats like Trump's 50% tariff on Brazilian goods.
Yeah, it's quite a divergence. The investment thesis really boils down to two things. They're exceptionally cheap, and policy is moving in their favor locally.
Cheap valuations.
They're cheap. The MSCI Latin America Index trades at a trailing P.E. ratio of around 11. Compare that to the MSCI USA Index at 29. It's practically giving away assets.
And the policy change? Interest rates?
Exactly. The region is entering an interest rate reduction cycle. Brazil's central bank rate is still way up at 15%, so the expectation of rapid cuts makes high dividend-paying stocks like utilities, financials, look highly attractive down there. That's a big reason why funds focused on the region are up, 38% on average year-to-date?
Okay, moving into some specific corporate stories now. Let's look at how this massive AI demand is reshaping even traditional sectors, starting with utilities. You mentioned them as a hedge, but they've also shifted from being just a defensive safety play to more of an aggressive growth engine.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Utilities were always the classic defensive investment, right? Stable, regulated cash flows. Now, they're kind of dual purpose. They still offer that defensive safety, but they're coupled with genuine aggressive growth prospects driven by that massive guaranteed energy demand from AI data centers. It's made them the second best performing sector this year.
So which companies are particularly well positioned to capture this new demand?
American Electric Power, AEP, is highlighted as looking particularly promising. Their service territory covers key data center hubs, Texas, Virginia, Ohio, exactly where the hyperscalers are building those huge power-hungry parks.
So they're right in the path of demand.
Perfectly positioned, really. Analysts project strong annual earnings per share growth for them, almost 7% through 2028, driven entirely by the need to build new assets to serve these big new customers. You combine that guaranteed growth with a solid 3.2% dividend yield. AEP offers both powerful offense and defense for investors right now.
Okay, switching over to healthcare. After years in the doldrums following that 2021 bubble pop, biotech seems to be finally crawling back. What's driving this comeback?
There seem to be three main structural catalysts lining up. First, just the general expectation of lower interest rates is pulling investors back towards riskier growth sectors like biotech.
Makes sense.
Second, there's been what they call a shutdown wave.
Yeah.
A lot of the, questionable startups that went public during the pandemic bubble have now failed. That clears out the market clutter and focuses specialist investor money on the higher quality firms remaining.
Survival of the fittest.
Kind of. And third, and this is probably the most critical driver, big pharma is facing major patent cliffs on huge blockbuster drugs. They have an urgent, pressing need for M&A activity to refill their pipelines. That hunger for acquisitions is fueling the whole upswing in biotech valuations.
Interesting. And yet, in the pharma space itself, Eli Lilly saw significant insider selling, even as they're in this huge race with Novo Nordisk on weight loss drugs.
Yeah, that was notable. The Lilly Endowment, which is a major nonprofit shareholder, not executives, but a major holder, they executed a significant selling spree, unloaded about $160 million in stock just in the first week of October.
Why now?
Well, the endowment sells shares periodically for its philanthropic mission. But the sheer scale and timing of these sales definitely caught the eye, especially given how much the company itself is investing in its own growth right now.
Okay, next up, some corporate drama where luxury meets the EV pivot, Ferrari. The stock plunged nearly 16% after they revealed their new Elettrica chassis. What happened there?
Yeah, big drop. And it wasn't because the car lacks performance. We're talking 1,000 horsepower, 192 miles per hour top speed. The plunge was triggered by lower than expected financial projections for the rest of the decade.
So the cost of going electric?
Exactly. The market seems really concerned about the complexity and the just staggering costs of this EV pivot. They're building a massive new e-building for production, incurring maybe $4.7 billion in cumulative spending through 2030. Those costs are weighing heavily on expectations for future margins.
But there's a deeper issue here too, isn't there? It's about brand and identity. Will the hardcore Ferrari enthusiast accept an electric Ferrari, even one that's incredibly fast?
That is the absolute existential question for them. Ferrari relies entirely on its brand cachet, that emotional connection. They actually had to build in this sophisticated system to amplify the electric motor's sound just to give the driver that auditory feedback they expect.
And how's that going over?
Well, the article quotes one longtime Ferrari owner who just found the amplified engine sounds very tacky.
Pouch, tacky is not a word you want associated with Ferrari.
Definitely not. When your core, dedicated fan base starts calling the essence of your new product tacky, you have a massive brand risk on your hands. And given that the stock trades at like 38 times estimated earnings, it's incredibly sensitive to any perceived misstep in maintaining that critical brand integrity.
Okay, shifting from luxury problems to alleged financial misconduct, the collapse of Tricolor Auto Group sounds like a powerful cautionary tale about due diligence, especially when Wall Street chases appealing labels.
This story is pretty shocking because Tricolor was this used car dealer focused on low-income Hispanic customers, and crucially, it was CDFI certified.
CDFI, Community Development Financial Institution. That government seal of approval suggesting a social mission.
Exactly. That designation implies they're helping underserved communities. Yet reports indicate they were selling cars at steep markups, repeatedly cited for issues like delaying title transfers, just not aligning with that social mission image.
And major U.S. banks apparently just missed massive red flags.
The failure of due diligence here by giants like Fifth Third and J.P. Morgan Chase seems profound, according to the reporting. They missed or maybe overlooked prior fraud allegations against the CEO and founder. Fifth Third Bank alone recently disclosed it could face up to $200 million in losses tied to alleged fraudulent activity at Tricolor.
$200 million? Wow.
It really highlights a critical failure in judgment. It seems like the appeal of that social lending designation, the CDFI certification, might have led sophisticated institutions to basically ignore fundamental due diligence and overlook clear signs of reckless or potentially fraudulent behavior.
A real cautionary tale. Okay, finally, let's wrap up with a couple of insider action items and a value play mention. First, FactSet. They had a terrible third quarter. Stock plunged 36%.
Yeah, brutal quarter. But despite that poor performance, FactSet's chief legal officer made a classic insider confidence signal, purchased $100,000 worth of shares in late September.
So management signaling belief despite the number.
Exactly. It signals deep management confidence in the company's long-term position, even while they're issuing conservative short-term guidance, blaming rigorous client approval processes. When the CLO steps up to buy personally after a major plunge like that, it's a strong vote of confidence against the market's short-term fear.
Okay. And last one, the argument for buying Goldman Sachs stock, positioned as having superior risk management in this volatile market.
Yeah, the thesis is really rooted in Goldman's distinctive culture, often described as being long-term greedy. The idea is they're positioned to navigate market uncertainty better than competitors because of their deep expertise across banking, trading, analysis. They're up 38% year-to-date, outperforming.
And the suggestion is either buy the stock or use options.
Right. Either buy the stock outright if you share the conviction, or use an option strategy like selling January puts and buying a call spread to potentially capture upside while rigorously defining your downside risk. Classic golden play, perhaps.
Okay. We have covered a tremendous amount of ground today, really conducted a comprehensive deep dive into the financial arteries of the global economy via this week's Barron's. If we try to synthesize the critical takeaways, maybe three big themes stand out for me.
Yeah, I agree. First, the AI trade. It's absolutely real, driving huge growth and progress, but it's also, as we discussed, precariously structured. Unprecedented circular financing, serious physical constraints on power and capital. It's complex.
Definitely. Second, high yield opportunities do exist, like in those discounted BDCs, but the influence of policy risk, whether it's the Fed's next move or the government shutdown's fallout, that's now a major overriding variable impacting almost everyone's expected return.
Mm-hmm. Policy looms large. And third, financial fears are deeply human. That psychology piece was fascinating. Wealth doesn't eliminate worry, it just swaps market loss anxiety for these deep issues of family strife, inheritance fairness, and finding personal identity in retirement.
Yeah, the mathematical versus the psychological.
Right. And, you know, we explored structural solutions for managing market chaos in the magazine, from Victor Hagani's ideas on rules-based allocation to handle sizing risk, to Kevin Warsh's demand for restored Fed credibility. It makes you think.
Oh, on.
Well, considering this intensely financialized world we're in where, as we saw, political decisions instantly affect market sizing, volatility, even the yield on Apple bonds compared to treasuries, here's a thought for you, the listener. What simple rules-based framework can you adopt to accurately measure and maybe size your portfolio's inherent political risk separate from traditional market risk?
That is indeed a deep dive question worth exploring for yourself. Thank you so much for joining us for this comprehensive exploration of this week's most critical financial narratives from Barron's.
Yeah, we really hope this deep dive helps you make better, more informed decisions in the volatile market environment ahead.